I want to continue, and I suppose I could continue calling this reflections on of a grandfather, but I want to zero in primarily tonight on reflections on love, and probably more especially on the enemies of love. First, I think we've got to remind ourselves what God means by love. And normally, I think we think of love largely as an emotion, a great emotion. But you can also think of love as a style of life, quite apart from the emotional content of that love. And when we talk about God's love, or agape, we've got to remember that this is quite different in many respects from what normally we think of as human love. I can put it in this way, that you can't stop God from loving you. Now, I think you could stop any human being from loving you, but you can't stop God from loving you, no matter what you do or what you are. It's in a sense, he loves you because it's his nature to love. It doesn't sound very laudatory, as if he can't help it, but but nonetheless, I think we have to put it that way. If you're trying to contrast human and divine love, you could say that it's human to love the lovely or be attracted to the attractive. It's divine to love the unlovely, to be attracted to the unattractive, and by the sheer power of that love, often, in many cases, change the unlovely into the lovely. It's also human sometimes for a person to love someone because of the possibilities that that person shows. Let's say a teacher who sees an incorrigible kid, great possibilities, and she lavishes upon him her attention and even affection in the prospect, really, of having him be what he yet isn't. Now that's human too. Now if God's love should be like that, if he should have loved us because of our possibilities, after 2,000 years, would he not long since have given up on the human race? And for God, love is an end in itself. It's not a means toward an end. In fact, love should never be a means toward an end, a tool. He saved us, or he died on a cross because he loves us. He didn't love us in order to save us. If I, supposing a person moves in a house across the street from me, and the first day he's mowing his lawn and I'm mowing mine, and he comes over and is very friendly. That warms me, and before the day is over, he's invited me over for coffee. I should have done it for him, but he did it. And the next two or three weeks, he shows such friendship to me that I'm just pleased no end. And then, let's say about the third week, one day he says, "Al, could I help you with your insurance?" And I say, "No, I'm sorry, I just had my insurance gone over." And supposing then he never shows any friendship anymore. And that really was a great letdown to me, because I thought he wasn't being friendly in order to do something to me. He was simply friendly. Now, if God should love us in order to change us, that would be demeaning of love. You'd have to say that God loves us no matter whether he is able to get us or not, or do anything with us, that he loves those in hell as much as he loves those in heaven. These are all his children, and he loves them with an unending love. This is what we've got to understand by the love of God. Now, since he loves us, he wants, of course, to meet our needs. And since we are eternal beings, we have two classes of needs. We have the eternal need, that is, the need to be brought back to him. But as long as we're on this earth, we have secondary needs, food and clothing and a whole assortment of needs that belong, if you will, to the body. Now, we've revolted a little against the dividing a person into body and soul, and I can understand that. And there was harm in doing that, as if we could love the person's soul and neglect him as a body. And in recent years, there's been a revulsion against that. In theological circles, we've almost wanted to get rid of the term soul as having been an intruder from the Greek world instead of being from the Hebrew world. I'm not sure that that's too important. I don't think we'll ever get rid of the word soul, because it has a certain content. It talks about us as having greater significance than bounded by birth and death, and that we have needs that all the needs of the body could not supply, because we are different. We are eternal beings. And the task of the church has sometimes been defined as restricted to the soul. It is sometimes evangelism is that what is our task? Our task is to tell the story in order to bring people back to God. And that, of course, is definitely a primary task of the church. But then sometimes that has been pitted over against what's called the social gospel, meeting the needs of food and clothing and those needs that belong to our short tenure here. It's too bad to divide these, but I think the word souls has to stay in the language. I was visiting with an old friend of mine down in a former town where I had a parish, and he belonged to the Greek Orthodox Church and had been very successful in the restaurant business. And now he was about 70, and I stopped in when I went through town one day, and he always, I'd get a good free meal if I stopped in his restaurant. And so we sat visiting, and I said, "Paul, how have things been going?" And he said, "Just fine." And I knew he had prospered, that he was a relatively rich man now. And he said, "My son is, I think, ready to take over, and I feel fine." And then there was a pause, and his eyes filled with tears, and he said, "But Al, I haven't taken time for my soul. I haven't taken time for my soul." And I thought afterwards, how would Paul have said that if he hadn't used the word soul? He couldn't have said, "I haven't taken time for my total man. I haven't taken time for my personality." There's no way, it seemed to me, in our language, for him to say what he wanted to say without the use of the word soul. And yet, when God loves us, while he has the greatest stake in bringing us back to him, and come what may, whether we have food and shelter and clothing, or whether the whole thing collapses, as far as our temporal needs are concerned, his chief concern has to be to capture what we've traditionally called the soul. But he is out to meet our needs, and our needs these few swift years we have are, many of them, very material needs. And no religion has been, or of all the religions of the world, the Christian religion has been called the most materialistic, because it has taken most seriously these temporal needs of the human being. And when Jesus told the parable of the great final judgment, he didn't say, I was unsaved and you didn't save me. He didn't say that. He said, "I was hungry and you didn't give me to eat." He started with these elemental needs. If you can't love somebody in terms of these needs that you can see, don't talk to me about loving the person as an eternal being. This comes through again and again in Jesus talking to his disciples or talking to people. So that the evangelism, the love of a person as an eternal being to bring him back to God, on the one hand, and the love of the eternal being to meet his needs of hunger and thirst and loneliness and despair and all of those, those must go together. And the striking fact is that where the church, when the church has been concerned about the human being as an eternal being, that is a strong evangelical note, it's generally in those instances where the greatest change has come about in the betterment of conditions that are temporal and materialistic. John Wesley's movement in England, for instance, was a great movement of evangelism, but there was nothing in British history that altered the conditions of employment for children and women and a number of things like that, as did the aftermath of the Methodist movement. And I think of this great man Wilberforce, who at the age of 21 was in Parliament, and at the age of 24 had a decisive encounter with God, and for the moment at least he thought to leave Parliament and enter evangelistic work. And then his friend, the younger Pitt, persuaded him to stay in Parliament, and Pitt himself against the cancer of the empire, which was the legalized slave traffic. And this Wilberforce, with tremendous moral fervor and buttressed by the younger Pitt in a strategic political way, in the period of 20 or 30 years, got rid of the legal slave traffic in England. And not that alone, but persuaded Parliament to recompense all the slaveholders with millions of pounds of money out of the public treasury, which wasn't the case in the United States in the post-Civil War period. But there was that high motivation of a person who took his eternal status seriously and took it seriously for the black disfranchised people. Now, the fact of the matter was that he didn't like blacks, and he didn't care for them, and he thought they were, by nature, less competent or less equipped than white people. So he had them on a lower echelon. You might say he was a racist, but he was evangelically moved to regard these people as children of God, even though they weren't children on the same status as those of the whites. So the two go together, the needs of the human being are double. The needs that you would call, for sake of a better term, eternal, and those that are temporal. And Jesus never divided them. He had them be together. Now, when Jesus said, "Now you love one another as I have loved you," he's really putting us to the test. And I could very well say to him, but God, you know that's impossible for me. There are an awful lot of people I live with that are awfully hard to like, you know that, and I don't know, I just can't do this. And I think he'd say, "Now, just a minute, I didn't ask you to like them. I didn't ask you to like them. I know there's a lot of things about them it's hard to like. In fact, I'm having quite a lot of trouble with you myself, but that didn't change the fact that I died for you. And I go to the lengths, all lengths for you, whether I like you or not." the things about you. And he, in effect, say, that's quite irrelevant what you feel about them. You go and do for them. That's what it is. When I talk about love, I'm talking about you're going to meet their needs regardless of any emotional content that you may have. You may be repulsed by them. You may have no inclination whatever to help them. And that must have been what he said, what he meant when he said, love your enemies. But he couldn't expect me to like them. And fortunately, he doesn't ask me that. Now, of course, there's an epilogue in most instances. If I set out to meet his needs, disliking him as I do, it is altogether possible that the Spirit of God may help me gradually to like him. That is, to have some emotional content in doing this. But that's not the first step by any means. Now, I think there's several presuppositions that I have to come to terms with if I'm going to even touch this kind of love. And the first one is that I've got to recognize that I am of eternal value. And if I am of eternal value, you are too. That is, I can't treat myself casually anymore because too great a price has been paid for me, and initially too priceless a label was put on me. I was made a child of God, and I have that station, and I can't sell myself short. And by the same token, I can't sell you short. I have to stand in awe over against myself, and I have to stand in awe over against the immeasurable worth that you are. Now that's not easy to do. It's not easy to do over against yourself, because it's quite easy to berate yourself and quite easy not to like yourself at all. But that probably hasn't got much to do with it. You've got to be convinced, or say that this is the presupposition I work with, that I'm that kind of a being. You know, I've sat in airports or in bus depots particularly. That's a more heterodox place. And watch these people milling around, and occasionally I zero in on one person. I don't know him. He may be attractive, he may not be attractive. And I say to myself, he is a whole world in himself. He's a whole world, like I'm a world in myself. And all the longings and yearnings and the disappointments and the ambitions and the hurts and the loves and the hates and the joys, all churning around in him. And he's the kind of person that Jesus thought important enough to come down to earth and die for. And as I sit in a bus depot and just kind of look at him, it seems as though the whole of existence takes on a sort of a sheen, a strange, pulsating reality that I can quite easily overlook as I move about with people. But that's the premise number one. If we're to enter into this kind of a world of love at all, we have to put a higher price on human beings. Now, it's not as difficult here. Even with a few days, I get to know a number of you, and I can see how what immeasurable possibilities there are in each person, and I wonder what the years are going to do for each of you. And you don't have as hard a time standing over against one another in sort of wonder and awe in a community like this as you would in the hubbub of life generally. Then I must remember that the command is to try to ascertain the needs of a person or people and try to meet that need. Now, if the odds are absolutely against it, My relation with an individual, and I want to help him. But he rebuffs me. He doesn't take kindly to this. And any effort that I make seems kind of a blundering effort. At that point, I have to use some judgment, of course. But that doesn't let me off. The fact that the odds of my helping him seem so great against it. I remember the story told about a Coast Guard crew assigned to help shipwrecked people in distress, and one day there was a terrible storm one night, and the ship was floundering in the reefs, and the captain ordered the boat out, and the first mate said, "Captain, it's insane to go out. The gale is of it's a terrible gale, and it's offshore, and the reefs out there are terribly treacherous. We conceivably could get out there, but we could never get back." And the captain said, "Launch the boat. We don't have to get back. We've got to go out." Now, I think there's that kind of compulsion in this agape love. The consequences are not up to you, but the imperative is ours. To try. Now, I've certainly, as I'm sure all of you have abstained from trying a lot of times for fear of being rebuffed, for fear of bungling it. And I've settled for just praying about it, which I think is something. But I again and again, I've felt guilty about not launching the boat, no matter what. And guilty about the only launching I did was some prayers. I should have tried better than that. But we've got to try, no matter what the odds are against it. And then I have to be open to, I think, the emotional content coming to brace me in this, so that it's not just an odious task, but that it gets to take on a certain strange kind of joy. I think it does. For every time that a person does something for the need of another, and particularly if he doesn't like that person, I think for every time he does that, he's taking one longer step into the strangeness and the wonder of the kingdom of God. Where you realize that this finally is reality. This is what life is all about. But the hurdles are there. Now I want to call attention to three enemies of this love, of being able to do it, or enter into it. And one of them is fear. I suppose one kind of fear is worse than another. If it's fear of losing station, losing credibility, losing money, losing power, losing face, losing any of those things that belong to the self, in not the most meritorious way, I suppose that's the worst kind of fear. Because that really blocks you out from going to help somebody. But all kinds of fear, I think, are paralyzing, and yet we're going to have them. A lot of anxiety immobilizes a person. And you can't deal with it rationally. I remember a kind of acute story out of World War I, when our boys were fighting in foxholes in trenches in France. We said a young fellow was scared of being drafted, and his friend said, "Don't worry, there's nothing to worry about. You're either drafted or you're not drafted. If you're not drafted, there's nothing to worry about." And if you're drafted, you go overseas or you don't go overseas. If you don't go overseas, there's nothing to worry about. And if you go overseas, you either go up to the front or you don't go up to the front. If you don't go up to the front, there's nothing to worry about. If you go up to the front, you either go over the top or you don't go over the top. If you don't go over the top, there's nothing to worry about. And if you go over the top, you're either wounded or you're not wounded. If you're not wounded, there's nothing to worry about. And if you're wounded, you either recover or you don't recover. If you recover, there's nothing to worry about. And if you don't recover, you die, and all worry is at an end. Nothing to worry about. I'm not so sure that it solved his fears. But fear is a powerful deterrent. And I've often thought that the opposite of fear, or the opposite of love, is not hatred, but fear. And Jesus said, perfect love will cast out fear. Because that must be the enemy of love. And if you have too many fears for yourself, how can you have any particular concern for others? And I think probably when the Bible uses the language that we must die, the self, it's always defensive of oneself, or has self-pity, or always has self-concern, or self-aggrandizement, or whatever you say. That self has to diminish or die if you're going to be free to swing free to the needs of other people. But, of course, that's a lifelong. We'll never lick it. But I think it's well to recognize it, that it's there. Now, I don't think there's any harm, and there's a lot of good, in having power, in being very intelligent and clever, having a lot of money. If these gifts are employed for the needs of others. But they're very tricky gifts to handle, because they tend to not free a person, but tend to tyrannize a person, make it impossible for the person to be free anymore, that the power has captured, or the wealth has captured, or the need for prestige has captured. And if a person, on the other hand, can be entrusted with these and swing free, it's a marvelous thing. And I think that's why God gives us whatever power, influence, or whatever we may have, gifts, in order that they might be dedicated as servants to others, and therefore be the implements of love. A second type of enemy, I think, is prejudice of one kind or another. And who doesn't have them? I don't know what prejudices you have, but I've had prejudices all along the line, I know. I remember 15, 20 years ago when the fellows at the seminary began to sprout beards and long hair, you know, I just didn't like that. And when one of them got up to lead the service, I kind of closed my eyes and listened to him instead of looking at him. Then I discovered that I'd grown up, as my generation had, and the only people identified with long beards and long hair were anarchists, Bolsheviks, and the cartoons were all on that side. And since Mr. Gillette had given us an easy way out to look respectable, it seemed to me incongruous that somebody would want to get involved with this anarchistic crowd and have a beard. And I had to work with that a little. And the country is still working with it. Now, up here, you can wear anything you like, and nobody's going to count it to your discredit. But I'm waiting for the day when a candidate for president will come out with a beard. Then I think we will have made it. And you see, that hasn't happened since 1916, when Charles Evans Hughes ran for president. He didn't make it, on the other hand, but I don't think it was his beard at all. At that time, Woodrow Wilson promised to keep us out of the war, and which he did for 3 months after he got elected, and then we were in it. Most, I suppose the prejudice we talk about most is ethnic or racial. And I don't know how many of you think you've got any racial prejudices. I didn't think I had any until Wayne and Tootie, my daughter, adopted Michael, a black boy. And when they told me they were going to do that, of course I didn't protest. And since that time, Peter and Jerry have adopted two. Now they're probably more white blood than black. Little Sarah has blue eyes and blonde curly hair. But she'll have to be classified as black because of the arrogance of the white race that refuses to acknowledge as white anybody who has a tint of other colors. But at that time, I remember hoping that Tootie and Wayne wouldn't do it. I asked myself why, and I tried to defend myself by saying, well, there are going to be doors closed to them, and they're going to have hurts that they otherwise wouldn't have if their children were all white. Now they've got three of their own, blonde as Norwegians and Germans are. And I said to myself, I guess you are a racist. Even though I certainly had black friends whom I regarded highly, and I didn't think I was a racist. And one night, Nora and I were sitting talking about this, and you know, it's a question, of course, whether this is wise or not. But Nora had asked a black social worker about it, and she said, I don't think it's a wise thing because it's hard to handle. But, she said, then you have to ask yourself, what is the alternative for this little kid? A series of foster homes or languishing in an institution? And with the difficulties that are involved, he will have the love of someone who tries very hard to love him as much as anybody, as much as they can. Well, we were talking about it. I said to Nora, I know how we could have prevented this in the first place. We should never have told our kids about Jesus.
Yeah.
That wouldn't have solved it. And I'm sure that's what moved them, this compassion, and to love those who were in need. But the racial prejudice is very strong, and they've encountered some of it in Madison, Wisconsin, where Tootie and Wayne lived for a while. Their neighbor wouldn't let Mike come and play in their yard. Here's a little boy, 10 years old, 8 years old, a nice boy. Tootie sometimes says, gee, I wish our own kids had dispositions as nice as Mike. Well, Tootie kind of outmaneuvered the neighbors. She made things so interesting in their yard that the neighbor kids defied their mother and came over to Tootie's yard and played. But the prejudice is there, and it's a very difficult one to handle. And I don't know what the answer is. Maybe over a long period of time, there's enough intermingling of the blood to make it. When I was down in Mexico City for a week, about the fifth day it dawned on me that the handsome people there were the brown people, those with this bronze skin, and we were the pallid, bleached out ones. And if someone had come from another planet with a, you know, an objective point of view, we would be relegated to the lowest rung so far as beauty is concerned, and all these rich colored people would get the prizes. I suppose we're making it in some way through having so many heroes. I talked to a doctor friend, well, he was here, Dr. Robbie, do you remember, last year? And his brother made the statement about South Africa, that there would probably be a breakthrough there because the white athletes who now were prevented from international contests because of the apartheid were insisting on the government changing its policy and allowing blacks to play on teams. And he thought there might be a breakthrough there. And then I thought, well, when did the breakthrough come for us on that score? Only a few years ago, when the Dodgers, and then in Brooklyn, took on Robinson. It's just a generation. And now, who are the heroes? Not the whites any longer on your basketball and baseball and particularly football teams. And then we have some great actors. So I think we're making it, but I don't know how profoundly this ethnic prejudice may lie with, I hope not with the generation to which most of you belong, but it certainly has been a part of my generation. A third enemy is the ideologies. And I have to, that's a tricky one, because ideas are very important. But when you stop to think of what happened in Zhivago, for instance, what was his name, the purist in the first part of the movie, you know, who was in... Pardon? Yes. Yes. And I found myself, applauding him, first part of the... he was dedicated. He wasn't an opportunist. He was really dedicated to the ideology of the revolution. And then in the latter part of the movie or the book, when he could decimate whole villages because they wouldn't buy the ideology, then you saw the cruelty of ideas. When ideas become more important than people, or when truth, in a sense, becomes more important than love, then there's something basically wrong with what's happened. And this has happened so often in the life of the church that you almost despair. On the one hand, I have to remember that ideologies, or what you believe, is of tremendous importance, because what you believe will sprout wings and take you off with them. If my brother believed in ghosts, and he believed ardently in ghosts, and I didn't believe in ghosts, I said, brother, you believe as you will. I have no objection to your difference in belief, but I want you to be sincere. If you really believe that, really believe it. Don't be a hypocrite. And I'll really respect you if you really believe it. Well, supposing he really believes it, so that he doesn't dare to go into a house at night alone. He doesn't dare to walk out in the dark alone. And in the morning when the sun is shining, his whole day is crowded with, is overhanging with these clouds of fear of the oncoming night and ghosts. What kind of a brother would I be to tolerate that and say, well, I'm a tolerant individual, and all I ask is that you be sincere. Well, who was more sincere, I suspect, who was more sincere about the primacy of the Saxon or the Teuton or the Nordic than Mr. Hitler? He really believed it, that the white man or the flaxen-colored hair and the blue eyes should govern the world, and those with brown eyes and dark hair and dark skin should be the peons. He really believed that. And that caused a little trouble for the world. So the idea that ideas are important, I have no difficulty buying. And I guess I have to be proud of the Lutheran Church that has always thought confessions were important, that what a person believed was very important. Now, he ought to be sincere about what he believes, but it was quite clear to Luther that it isn't enough to be sincere. The more sincere and intense you are about an untruth, the more damaging that untruth is. If you're not sincere about it, if it doesn't matter much to you, then so what? But if it does matter to you and it's wrong, it could lead to all kinds of mischief. So I'm not disparaging the Lutheran Church in its insistence on theology and clarity of biblical interpretation and great respect for the findings of the people of God as articulated down through the centuries in the one holy Christian church. But this fidelity of the Lutheran Church to confessionalism has had its mischief, as you know. And I think of our own history in the Norwegian, among the Norwegians, when back in 1880 and 1890, these congregations were split and families were split. And I know one notable family where the brothers divided. One went into one group and the other into the other. And when the mother died and the family gathered, they couldn't pray together at the mother's grave because they believed that they ought not to pray with those who disagreed with them as far as truth was concerned. Now that, then you have to say that this had gone to absurdity. It had become absurd. And that's what's happening in our friend's church or the Missouri Synod at the moment. We're attempting to find a statement of truth about the authority of Scripture. They're letting love be a casualty, and it shouldn't be. I have no quarrel with either, if there are two sides in the Missouri Church at the moment, I have no quarrel with either side believing that their point of view is more faithful to God and the Scriptures than the other side, either side. I have no quarrel with it. But each one ought to have charity and a sense of humor, if nothing else. Not to take themselves so seriously that love becomes a casualty. It's really tragic when that happens, and it means that, well, if you can't pray together, can you? I was talking to one of my friends, and I said, isn't that crazy that unless you have thorough doctrinal agreement, you can't pray together? I said, supposing you marry a Methodist, and she doesn't want to become a Lutheran. You can go to bed together and have 10 kids together, but you can't pray together. According to your, that would be sinful unionism, while having kids together would be unsinful unionism. You know, there's such absurd ends that you come with in situations like that. But just think, I hope the day is over. It isn't over. It isn't over in Uganda. It isn't over in Ireland, where people are willing to kill others because they've got the wrong beliefs. And this was quite common back in the Middle Ages, and Luther wasn't exempt from it. Luther, of course, was caught in an ideological controversy profound one with the church. And then he's guilty of having, I shouldn't say guilty, but he did make statements like, if you have to choose between truth and love, let love go. He did say that. And but I think 400 years has made a difference. I think the Holy Spirit has led us along the way, so that it's inconceivable to me that we'd start killing each other off because we had different confessions. Now, maybe it'll come again. I hope not. It would be terrible to live in that kind of a day. Of course, we've had it in political ideologies. Still have it. Well, anyway, talking to one of my friends who's on the right side, I mean the extreme right in Missouri, not the laudable side, but I said the Lutheran Church had prided itself on taking original sin and the fall seriously, that the human being was damaged. His will was damaged, his mind was damaged, his heart was damaged, so that he couldn't, we've been very clear on that we can't of ourselves produce a pure, holy act. It will be blemished in some way. But I said, we've made a mistake in contending, in implying at least, that the mind wasn't damaged, but can produce a pure proposition, you know. And I said, I think we're heretical on that score. Well, of course, the label he least wanted to have was to be a heretic. But I think there is that. I liked what Karl Barth one time said. He said, the angels laugh at old Karl. He comes with one volume of dogmatics after another. And here they say, here he comes with his push cart full of dogmatic books. And they laugh at him. Here he thinks that he's been able to put into words everything that needs to be said about God. And then they also laugh at the people who write so much about Karl Barth instead of writing about the things that Karl Barth writes about. So he says the angels laugh. And that's a delightful touch. This tremendous theologian who could see that his best efforts were not the absolute, and that there had to be a sense of humor. And a sense of humor, rightly understood, is always a sense of charity. Well, now you can think of other enemies. But I'll stop there. Master?
Yeah.
You do?
Yeah.
You had trouble marrying a black man?
No. I worked with some Mexican wetbacks this fall, and being outside the restaurant with them in the world was amazing, even among people my age. It's just part of it, you know. I don't know how much of it is racial and how much of it is cultural. I mean, and the fear between cultures, alien cultures, is really strong. And I don't know if that's the same thing as racial, or, you know, if it's the color of the skin and the twist of the tongue or what. But the worst thing was not finding the prejudice in other people, but finding it in myself. That I did not treat them in the same, you know, or with the same love that I treat other people. And it's difficult because you don't know how as well.
Yeah.
But I think there's definitely a fear,
mm-hmm.
a lock, you know, that you put on your heart for no good reason.
Is it possible to forget the cultural differences and say, well, you know, like Shylock says in Merchant of Venice, if you prick us, do we not bleed? You know, aren't we all the same?
I hope so. And I think if we allow ourselves to live with people who are different, and we bring ourselves to situations where we know we'll have to confront other cultures and other races, then I think it's real possible.
Mm-hmm.
But the tendency, at least in me, is just to look the other way, you know, well, I don't have to go over there right now,
mm-hmm.
you know, and just avoid it. And mm-hmm. as long as I do that, there isn't much hope. Yeah, I think it's definitely possible.
I don't know if it would be so much to forget the cultural differences, but to overcome them. And cultural differences are enriching.
Mm-hmm.
If I had a friend in another culture, I wouldn't think I'd want to forget that, but I'd want to be able to appreciate it and overcome that difference. And it's the fear, I think, like Alsa said, I think the fear is the worst
mm-hmm.
thing to overcome.
Mm-hmm.
Fear of rejection and a fear of and the other person is having the same fear.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Then you look at real small children. They don't have these prejudices.
No.
They can play together, like you said, even up to the 10-year-old. The neighbor kids come in and play in the forbidden yard.
Mm-hmm.
And then as we get older, and where do these prejudices come from?
Mm-hmm.
We were, or a couple of people, I can't remember who I was talking to all together, but we were talking about experiences of being in school in foreign places when we were young. And they happened to be, for me, there were Scandinavian and German and one girl was called in France, and we had very similar, very foreign, we were the foreigners experiences. And maybe it's part of our problem in the United States that we don't have a lot of students. We don't recognize the cultural differences among ourselves
mm-hmm.
the way European continents have had. We are the same nation, but we can have different cultures and nations.
Mm-hmm.
It's something I'm thinking of that in a different level, maybe, I don't know, that's come into my head, and that's kind of apostolic admonition to practice hospitality among ourselves. And somehow, hospitality seems a very simple thing. It does recognize differences in some sense. You know, we're in and out of each other's homes, and
mm-hmm.
I'm at home in my culture.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, it's, I don't know, I don't, to say I have to love, and love is a, sometimes I have to break that word into its other forms, and it's hospitable. You know, to be open to another, it's a good form of tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have trouble falling through one side.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow that's, there's give and take that's about hospitality. It doesn't demand something of a person to come into my home.
Mm-hmm.
Be there for that person.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wish we could cross culture that way.
Mm-hmm. We had a boy from Uganda live with us for a year when he was a high school, about the age of our youngest son, senior in high school. But he belonged to the Buganda tribe, and this was before the upheavals, and the educated tribe in Uganda. His father had been educated in England, so that he was Islam and was supposed to observe his own faith. We had a touch of it then, but I don't think we ever felt any, did we, Nora, any ethnic problem? Because he was of the minority. He was one among all kinds of whites.
I think we that's the point. I can't remember thinking of his blackness either.
Except when we took a picture of him. We couldn't see his face, only his white shirt.
And his white teeth and his white eyeballs. That's all it showed in the picture. I don't know how they do take pictures. They try the I couldn't even send him home with him because I thought, I couldn't imagine, I didn't even show him to him. That was a funny thing. I was real disgusted with him because when Ramadan came along, and I had read up on this, I knew that he was to observe, and I thought it was an awful nuisance, but I was ready and willing because I thought he were Muslim, and he went to church with us. I think he even confessed the faith. He'd gone to an Anglican school, so these were not strange words to him. He'd sit up in the choir. He didn't sing, but our youngest son was in the choir, so he sat behind there with him. But when Ramadan came, and we went on a field trip, and I said, "Now, Abraham, you tell me when it's time," because I wasn't even quite sure, and he was to find out and let me know. We were on a field trip, and I was driving, and one of the fellows said to him, "How do you like this Ramadan, Abraham?" And I stopped the car, and Abraham, and he laughed. He thought he... funny joke. He put one over on me. And so I thought, well, we were a week into Ramadan, there was no point at this time, and so we didn't observe it. And I discovered after, I'm fairly sure that he did not observe it in his home either. I think they were, or at least he was not that orthodox. I didn't know why that made me feel bad. I thought, you know, it was strange to have a non-Christian living in your home.
And well, I'm going to be sincere, isn't
it? Right? Well, I'm going to be sincere.
Yeah, you must. Right.
Yeah.
It was
strange.
Yeah. Probably it was so nice because he wasn't sincere about it.
Did he when we had our family prayers?
No. He prayed the Lord's Prayer together with us, but of course that there's no Christology in the Lord's Prayer, at least explicit. I asked him what he thought of Jesus Christ, and he said, and he was one of the great prophets of the world. He said, "I don't believe he was crucified because I don't think God would let a wonderful person like that be treated that shameful."
I think numbers have a lot to do with prejudice. That, you know, if there's one dark-looking person in the room, that's okay, you can keep your eye on him. But if you're the one light person in a room full of dark people, it's very, very different. And I think that might have something to do with your experience in the French school. Just that everybody else was of that other culture. And you are, you know, the one of a few.
I worked in a church in Canada where there were many Indian people. Some of you have heard about that before, but our pastors in the church were determined that we were not going to be prejudiced and that we were going to extend ourselves in every way. And they did extend themselves as best they might. But at least one of them, I think, was under the illusion that he was treating the Indian people better than some of the rest of us, and I'm not sure that was so. He was treating them differently, and perhaps had less fear, say, than I did. I was afraid of those people because they were strange to me, and I didn't know what they were going to do, or how they were thinking, or when I was going to make a blunder, you know, mm-hmm. or any number of other things. I don't know that this fellow was afraid in that way, but by the end of the year, I had learned a little bit about the Indian people. I had become quite prejudiced against this other person, you know, So the race thing can cut both ways, I think. And it was so determined to shake it off, you know, and make it such a cause one way or the other, it causes countless other troubles not associated with race at all.
I think one of the really frightening things that you brought out is this thing of the ideology becoming a god. The idea is taking over with the people. It can sound so right.
Yeah.
And in a way, Christianity itself can become an ideology.
Yeah.
The crusades. That's sort of right in the extreme, but at what point, if you're dying for God, if you're offer your life for your belief, you know, at what point is that the real thing, or at what point are you, is that what's the test?
You mean becoming a martyr?
Yeah.
In a sense? Because you won't give up the faith, or you want to bend, or whatever.
Yeah.
That's hard to say. I think of the early church. Now there were martyrs who, let's say, refused to worship the emperor or whatever. I don't know the situations, but had they been willing, they would not have been, let's say, executed. I really don't know what I would do in this. There must have been many people, however, of the faith, who instead of choosing martyrdom, chose some kind of what we would call compromise or whatever, and survive. And who is to say? Now, if they'd all chosen martyrdom, I suppose it would have been the end of the church. But they survived in catacombs, and they infiltrated the government, and they, you know. I suppose you don't know what you'd do except in the concrete situation. I know with Smits and Rosenthal's, who fled Latvia and been on our professors at the seminary, I know they're very hesitant to condemn their fellow pastors who still are in Latvia and are functioning in some way. Now, obviously, they are functioning in limited freedom and are making their witness under circumstances that are quite circumspect. Otherwise, they'd be in prison. And I know both Rosenthal's and Smits would not condemn these people for having escaped Siberia in some way.
Do you know where your Ugandan friend is?
Well, Andrew, our youngest son, he and Patty were over in England 3-4 years ago, and I don't recall, do you know how they'd made connections, but he was doing a PhD at the University of Birmingham in political science at the time.
And didn't think that the way the situation was then, didn't think you could get home, and it certainly
hasn't changed
anything. Oh, it's gotten much worse. Someplace other than back in Uganda.
Yeah.
The other evening, when I was telling about, I don't remember the certain thing, I was talking about the World Council. I don't know what my thoughts were about the World Council. I did a whole bunch of criticism, and that the World Council, the Lutherans shouldn't belong, and so on and so forth, and all of this and that. And I don't suppose I ever decided or thought a whole lot about it. But when You sit in a country where less than 2% of the people are Christian, and you're sitting with a group of people that represent different faiths, all Christian faiths, from all around the world, all cultures, all nationalities, all ethnic groups, and yet each of them professing that Jesus Christ is Lord and Savior. All of a sudden, you think, if we've got something, you better hang in there and stick together. Because if you represent less than 2% of any country, they're going to have really quite a time, and only by uniting efforts, it seemed to me, would there be any hope of strength in Christianity being shown. And we live here where it's awfully easy to be critical of other groups. We're so in the minority in that kind of a situation world over. It's a little hard to visualize, I think, for us, and maybe we think we can afford to be intolerant.
Yeah, it's kind of funny to have a student come from Africa and you ask him what church he belongs to, and he's a Swedish Lutheran.
Oh, dear.
And then I remember somebody telling about the Lutheran missionary who wouldn't let his son play tennis with the Episcopal missionary's son, because these blacks might conclude that that the Episcopalians and the Lutherans had the same faith. Ad absurdum. The Lord must either weep or laugh or both, I think. Well, most of you kids are going to live another 30, 40, 50 years. The Lord gives you normal years, and we leave these problems to you.